Hello, hello everybody, and welcome to the Causes or Cures podcast. I'm Dr. Eakes, your host. So, I have a question for you. Would you ever consider donating one of your kidneys to a perfect stranger? How does that make you feel? And you can do just fine with one, but still, the idea of donating a kidney to a stranger probably produces a range of emotions from heck yeah, let's do it to hell no. But that's exactly what my guest, Elaine Perlman, did, as well as her son. They donated a kidney to a stranger, and she is going to walk us through the entire journey, including all the details and how it felt. Elaine is the director of Waitlist Zero, an organization that envisions a world where it's easy for patients to ask for a kidney if they need one and easy for donors to give. And in the podcast, she will talk more about Waitlist Zero, what it is, the current issues with kidney donation, the wait list, and the current kidney crisis. She'll tell us what that is in the podcast. And she'll also talk about the cost of donating a kidney and ways to make that easier for donors, or essentially that there are more available kidneys out there. All right. So give me a few seconds while we connect to Elaine. All right. We are connecting with Elaine Perlman, who is director of Waitlist Zero. And we're going to talk about Waitlist Zero, which is a really interesting organization. But first, you have such an interesting story. And I thought, well, tell us more about yourself and what you do and what you're doing now.
I would be delighted to share that. My journey has been a total surprise to me. I've been an educator for 33 years. I have taught early childhood for 7 years. That's kids under five. I've taught second through 11th grade. I've taught nearly every subject except for foreign language. And most recently, I was a professor at Columbia University, teaching people who served in the Peace Corps to become New York City public school teachers in under-resourced schools. I would teach them a 3-month course. We met every day preparing for the classroom, and then I supported them in their first 2 years of teaching. I love that job. It was really tailor-made for me, and I enjoyed it completely, working with these beautiful people who are service-oriented. In 20 17, my son at age 17 said to me, "I want to donate my kidney to a stranger." And at first, I was highly alarmed because I said, "Don't you have to be a relative to do that?" I barely knew what the kidney did. I thought it was just a vacuum cleaner for the body. And he, within 10 minutes, he's on the debate team. He was at the time and very persuasive. He showed me that it was about as safe as giving birth. He said, "You did that. And this is, obviously you thought it was safe enough, so you should have the same standard for this." He showed me a few articles and videos that showed me how life-giving organ donation was. And so I said to him, "If all goes well, I'll do it too." So in July of 2019, at age 19, my son AB donated his kidney to a 21-year-old New Yorker. They met on the set on live TV on the set of Good Morning America. It was one of the most emotional moments of my life. And 6 months later, I did the same. I launched a kidney chain at NYU Hospital. We both went to NYU and loved it. My former kidney flew to Georgia. And in order to receive that kidney, that person had to have a family member or a friend ready to donate to another stranger. So another kidney flew to Oklahoma. And then two more kidneys flew to Washington State. So in total, it was like four for the price of one. We got four kidney donations for my one gift.
Wow.
And it really changed my life. But even to that point, I'd never met anyone with kidney disease, still barely knew what the kidney did,
Yeah.
knew that we had one to keep and one to share if we wanted to. And we could live full and healthy lives with only one kidney. But it wasn't until COVID when my friend Mark Scotch, who bikes around the country promoting kidney donation and raising awareness, he biked through Times Square. I wanted to welcome him there. And I met these two beautiful men who needed kidneys, and I just felt this sense of hopelessness, like, I don't have another kidney to give you. What can I do to help? And so I became an advocate. I resigned from my position, and March 1st of 2022, I started working with Waitlist Zero. I'm also very interested in childhood nutrition, so I was at the same time volunteering at a school in the South Bronx, teaching parenting and grandparenting classes on cooking and encouraging the kids to eat healthier foods. And then in the summer of, or in the late spring, I organized a lobbying day to support the Living Donor Support Act up in Albany, brought this amazing team of people from a veterans organization, National Kidney Foundation, National Kidney Donation Organization, and just individuals who've donated their kidney to go up to Albany and persuade lawmakers to pass the Living Donor Support Act. At the beginning of the journey, my friend Ned Brooks, who leads the National Kidney Donation Organization, heard me say, I want to make New York the best place in the country to donate organs. And he said, yeah, when pigs fly, because New York is ranked number 49 out of 50 states. And he was just sort of funny about it.
Yeah.
And I said, that encouraged me more than anything. I just really wanted to have that gloating conversation with Ned once the Living Donor Support Act passed. It was passed unanimously in both houses, in the Assembly and Senate. The governor signed the bill in December, and now New York is the best place to donate in the country. You can imagine my joy at calling Ned. And now I'm trying to pass the same kind of full reimbursements for all donors of out-of-pocket costs and lost wages in Washington, D.C. on the federal level. So it's been wild, and I'm just so honored that I am provided this opportunity to truly change the system so that we have more living donors.
Yeah, no, that is a wild journey. I just listening to you, I was like, wow. So I'm curious. So your son, and I read that on your website, I read a little bit about the story. Where did he get that idea? It just, because he was young, and I don't have kids, but I feel like I have nephews, and I feel like that probably wouldn't be on their radar. And he was like, you know, it just seemed, where did he get the inspiration to even do that?
Well, honestly, when he was a little one, even 2 years old, he would do chores around the house. So he always had money in his pocket for homeless people. We live in Manhattan. We're very fortunate that we do have a place to live, and he's very aware that not everyone does. So from the very beginning, he was a very compassionate and empathetic person. By the time he was 17, he was a big reader and involved with the effective altruism movement. Dylan Matthews is a journalist with Vox. He donated his kidney to a stranger. That's how AB learned about it. I watched the video with AB after, you know, when he was trying to persuade me that this was a great idea. By the way, he was going to do it whether he had my approval or not. He was on his way to do it. He was just informing me, not asking permission, because he knew that this was something that once he learned about the opportunity, he really needed to do.
Interesting. So, you know, a lot of people, myself included, we don't know the specifics of, you know, what if you decide, hey, I want to give my kidney to someone. I think we're all generally aware we only need one kidney, one functioning kidney to survive, to live normal life. But what is the process when you made the decision, you know, okay, I'm going to do this too? Can you just give us kind of like, I guess, the cliff notes of what is that like from step one to, okay, there's this now my kidney was removed and it's on its way to somebody who needs it?
Great question. I felt like I won the lottery when I passed the inspection needed in order to donate my kidney. It was one of my most joyful moments. So just from start to finish, the way they do it at NYU Hospital, I think because New Yorkers are busy people, perhaps they do it quickly. I went to the hospital. They arranged for me an entire day of testing. I had been with AB during his day of testing. He came with me for mine. It involved blood work followed by a lot of tests. I met with a surgeon who explained the surgery, or at least in my case, attempted to. I asked him to not explain anything. I'm actually disgusted and completely, I'm grossed out by everything medical. So it makes it even funnier that I'm in this position. So I never learned the details of the surgery, but it is a laparoscopic surgery. People can check other resources for more details. They won't get them from me. Ignorance is bliss. And I met with a social worker who just made sure that I was aware of what the procedure entailed. They talked to me about the risks, in addition to making sure I wasn't being pressured or paid in any way. I had a CAT scan because it turns out that 1 in 1,000 people are born with only one kidney and another 1 in 1,000 are born with only one functioning kidney. They wanted to make sure I had two handsome kidneys inside. I had an EKG, a stress test, an x-ray, sort of a giant inspection of my insides to make sure that I would survive and thrive after the donation. It turns out that people who do go on to donate kidneys live longer than the general population because we do need to be in top health in order to donate.
And that makes from sense.
There, yeah. From there, I had once I passed that, I had a 24-hour urine collection, which of course had to be done during work day. So it was a little embarrassing, but I kept the jug in a couple bags. And then the final exam was a renal exam. I had to drink a gross milkshake, and then they checked my kidney function. It turns out that my left kidney is 2% better than my right kidney was. So they decided to leave me with the better kidney and take the one that was a little bit lower functioning.
Okay. And then I guess they scheduled the surgery. How are you feeling going into this?
Such excitement. Excitement. I can't, yeah. So I've had a lot of surgeries and I'm not afraid of pain. I just am disgusted by the thought of surgery itself. And so the way it works when you're donating to a stranger, it's around your schedule. They make it as convenient as possible. So for me, January was the best time in terms of my work life. And so once I gave the word that I was able to donate in a certain week, I worked with the National Kidney Registry, or I should say NYU worked with the National Kidney Registry. I think I was their first National Kidney Registry patient. And they input my details into the computer and up popped my best possible match. It's so important to have a great match, because then you can take fewer immunosuppressants after the surgery. Immunosuppressants are really hard on the body. So oftentimes I'm a mentor with the National Kidney Donation Organization for prospective donors, and I advise them to consider giving their kidney to a stranger so that the person they want to get the kidney can get the best possible match through their voucher system. Within a month, unless the person is highly sensitized, that means they're very hard to match, that their recipient will get a kidney that is the best possible match for them. So that's the way it worked.
And then, so you get the kidney was removed and given to a stranger, and your son met the person who received, but you don't know who received your kid. Is that right?
That's right. And it's really interesting because I'm a volunteer with the National Kidney Foundation. I'm on their community advocacy committee. And I met a man who received a kidney from a stranger and was extremely upset that that stranger did not want to meet him, took it very personally. And I feel really fortunate that the two of us met, because I explained to him why I didn't want to meet my recipient, and it made him feel so much better. The reason I don't want to meet my recipient is because I love the idea that my kidney, my former kidney, it's no longer mine, could be anywhere. And I could pass that person on the street. It just makes me, I've always loved people and I love strangers even more. I'll sometimes just think on the subway, my former kidney could be here. It just, to me, it's almost like a fable or a fairy tale where I've just released it into the world. And hopefully it's humming along and doing beautifully. I was informed the afternoon of my surgery. So my surgery was at 5 a.m. I think I got out at about 10 a.m. By the afternoon, they came in and told me my kidney was doing marvelously well.
So it's that fast. So they take it out and then just it flies to wherever it needs to be.
Exactly. I pictured it in first class, chilling out and having drinks. But in reality, it's in a container on ice.
Yeah.
And then once it's implanted, I've been told it's like you're taking an old car engine and implanting it in a Ferrari engine into the car. It starts working immediately, humming along really well. When someone gets a deceased donor kidney, it may take some time for the kidney to start working. The person may even need to continue with dialysis for a time. However, with a living donor kidney, they're just amazing.
And the process of recovery, I think people, you know, who might be considering this, they're like, well, what happens after the surgery? How long is the recovery process? Do you have to change any of your habits? Can you talk a little bit about that? What was that like for you?
Absolutely. So woke up the morning of the surgery. I actually made a video of myself in the hospital, in the sense, I just wanted to be able to encourage other people to do this thing. So I took videos of myself. I was walking around the hospital that day, meeting people, feeling a sense of tightness in my belly, but nothing that I would describe as pain. I was in the hospital for 3 nights. And the reason for that extra night, because most people it's only 2 nights, was because my urination took a while to warm up. I think post anesthesia, that can happen. My friend Steve was in the hospital for one night. AB, my son, was in the hospital for two nights. I was in there for three nights. I was also grateful for that third night because I live in an apartment that requires a six staircase walk up. And so having that extra night, I think, helped me get up those stairs with absolutely no problem. After that, so I was in the hospital for those three nights. As I said, I had really good pain relief. I took tramadol for 5 days, tapering slowly. And then I transitioned to extra-strength Tylenol. And within 2 weeks, I was on no painkiller at all. I worked from that first day on my hospital bed, answering emails and writing documents. So I was able to work right from the start. I think that that's a sign that Americans are really workaholics, right? Or maybe just I am, that I'm still working there. Yeah. But I was back at the office after 2 weeks. I found the recovery to be easier than my appendix operation, appendectomy, and easier than a lot of the other surgeries I've had as well. I can list them if you want, but it was really a far easier recovery. In my son's case, I think that he didn't get the same advice I did from the surgeon. My surgeon said, take your next painkiller 5 or 10 minutes before the next one, with the past one wears off. So that way you're never in the pain state. Because once we get into a pain state, we need more painkiller for longer. My son was not given that advice. He tried to take as few painkillers as possible. And he actually couldn't make it up the six flights of stairs after the 2 days. He spent a few nights at a friend's house recovering. I think it was because he was trying, you know, we're all afraid to become addicts. And so I think that he was just trying to stretch it out, but it was not the right thing. In the end, the advice I got from my doctor was really helpful.
And in terms of, you know, diet or healthy, any health habits, do you have to change anything? Do you have to do anything differently?
The only change is that we can no longer take, or we should no longer take, ibuprofen, Advil, because that medicine negatively impacts kidneys. It's a medication that people sometimes take like M&Ms, but in reality, 17,000 people die a year from Advil overdose. And they said to me, take Tylenol instead. It'll be bad for your liver. I thought, you know, I don't want anything bad for any organ in my body. So I did some deep Google searching and found that some scientific evidence that tart cherry juice works the same for anti-inflammation and for pain relief as Advil. 2 tablespoons of tart cherry juice concentrate is equivalent to 2 Advils. I buy it at the health food store. I keep it in my fridge in the concentrated version, and it's worked beautifully. I even had a crown put in the other day, very painful. 4 tablespoons of tart cherry juice, and I was good to go, feeling no pain. So that's a great discovery that I like to share.
I didn't know that about, but where I drink tart cherry juice, I lift weights. And after I lift weights for the recovery, that's what I do. I drink tart
cherry juice. So there we go. Pain relief, right?
It's supposed to help with the muscle pain that you get.
Exactly. Yeah. It works. I had COVID. I took tart cherry juice. I had that RSV respiratory illness. I also fasted. I drank a lot of liquids, but fasted and had COVID for only one day and RSV symptoms for only one day. So
now I saw on your website, you seem to be very into nutrition, but are you a vegan? You're still okay.
I'm very vegan. Yeah.
Very vegan.
I mean, you know, the stereotype.
I know what you mean by you say that though, because there's wishy-washy vegans out there too, which is, you know, everybody has their thing, but I get
unless someone seems resistant, I will talk about it and I will encourage people to become vegan. Cause I just figure before 2015, I knew nothing about the health benefits of being vegan. Now I'm a mentor for people who wish to become vegan through Plant Power Metro New York. I know that it can reverse chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease. It can stop the progression of kidney disease. I recently gave a workshop for the National Kidney Foundation about eating vegan, but keep in mind, vegan doesn't mean healthy. Vegan is Oreos and Coca-Cola. So a whole food plant-based diet. And at home, I am salt, oil, and sugar-free. Outside of the home, it's hard to do in restaurants and so on, but that's really my aim. Both my parents died of cancer, and their last few years were sort of a living death that I never want to experience. And so I work with people. I'm working right now with a cohort of people who've had heart attacks. And so I'm trying to help them get to a really healthy place so that they can reverse their own diseases.
Well, that's fantastic. All right, let's jump into Weightless Zero. because this is interesting. So from your website, written on the website, we envision an America where no one dies because of a shortage of available kidney transplants, a world where it is easy for patients to ask for a kidney and easy for donors to give. So, and you have a plan on that website and how that will happen. And I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about that? How do you plan to do that?
It's really a challenge. So right now, 92,000 Americans are registered on the kidney donor wait list, but that does not nearly encompass the number of people who would benefit from a kidney transplant. Many people don't even try to get onto that kidney list because the wait lists are so long. They're up to 10 years in places like California. You know, by the time someone has reached the 5-year mark with dialysis, which is a process where the blood is removed from the body, cleaned in some sort of way, and then put back in the body, it's a 12-hour a week process, usually 4 hours at a time, 3 days a week. By the time someone has hit the 5-year mark, half of that population has already died. It is a very great thing that we have the opportunity for people to live with kidney disease, but they describe dialysis as a living death where you're just exhausted and it's just so harsh on the body and harms the heart tremendously. What we have right now is this about 110 people dying a day from the kidney shortage. The sad thing about that is that if we didn't have a shortage, all those people would get an opportunity to live, like my recipient or like AB's recipient. We have the kidney shortage for a number of reasons. So the first act that we are trying to do is to make sure that no potential donors need to pull out of donation because they can't afford it. Donation is not expensive at all when it comes to the actual medical costs. It costs nothing to get the full inspection that I described earlier. It cost me nothing to stay in the hospital and to get the surgery. However, travel costs back and forth from the hospital, if I happen to have elder care, child care expenses, as well as wages that are lost in those 2 weeks I took off from work, it can become a really expensive venture. Now, the National Kidney Registry will provide a reimbursement for donors who give to strangers. I didn't ask at the time for my wage reimbursement because I thought, oh, I'll take sick days. At the time, not realizing that that cost me money. When I resigned, I could have had money back from those sick days. So I did lose about $4,000 to donate. The federal government has a program called the National Living Donor Assistance Center. We call it NALDAC for short. They give reimbursements to only 9% of donors. Now, you may ask yourself, why not 100% of donors? They have really strict parameters. A person, in order to be able to receive a reimbursement, has to earn as an individual less than $47,000. In addition, their recipient needs to earn less than $47,000, 350% of the poverty line. Now you ask yourself, why does the recipient income need to be factored in? Yeah. That was a real problem for my friend, Melissa, who makes less than $47,000, but her recipient made more than that. She didn't want to ask him to pay her $4,000 in out-of-pocket costs and lost wages. So she had to host a GoFundMe in order to be able to afford to save her friend's life. Some people need to borrow money. What I would like, and what Waitlist Zero is working on, is to pass what we just passed in 2022 in New York State, the Living Donor Support Act, to reimburse all donors, regardless of their income, regardless of the recipient's income. We're trying to do this now on the federal level. We're calling it the HOLD Act, the Honor Our Living Donors Act. We're looking for sponsors and then eventually co-sponsors for this bill. I really want it to be passed this year because every morning I wake up and it's very distressing when I think about the 110 people that will die that day. This is a way to make donation affordable. So that is the first step in reducing the wait list, not eliminating the wait list, but reducing the wait list. How do we entirely eliminate the wait list? I think we need to look at other countries and how they've navigated their organ shortage. One way that Israel and Saudi Arabia have accomplished a huge reduction in their wait list is to offer a suite of benefits to donors. For example, payment of their premiums for health insurance or life insurance, giving them free admission for life to national parks. In Israel, and I think in Saudi Arabia as well, a 1-week vacation to recover. Things like that, I think down the line could possibly be passed. Not right now. Right now, I think our main aim is make it a cost neutral experience to donate. And that is the reason why most donors are on the wealthier side is because it is expensive. We need to open it up so that all people, regardless of income, can donate. And then from there, we'll work on trying to bring in some incentives or benefits for donors. But I think that's a long way down the line and requires a lot of education. Right now, we pay for sperm, eggs, hair, all kinds of things. We can rent a person's womb. No one in leadership at this moment is really in favor of incentivizing donation. But if we want to get rid of the wait list entirely, I think we need to go in that direction. But for now, let's make it cost neutral. At the very minimum, let's make sure that no one spends a dollar to donate.
And that's interesting. So it's people who have higher incomes who are most likely to be donors, because there is no, they want to help people. But yeah, it doesn't. What are some of the arguments against incentivizing?
So just to clarify, the HOLD Act is cost neutral reimbursement.
Cost neutral, right. Okay.
Yeah. So far, no one has opposed this. I did hear from one person who said, well, that sounds like incentivization. And I replied with, that's just makes it cost neutral. Incentivization implies that there's some benefit, some sort of extra dollar earned by donation. This would just reimburse what is spent. So far, really, no one is opposing reimbursement. I think it's just about getting all of our ducks in order so that we have a bill in place that gets wide support. As I said earlier, the Living Donor Support Act was passed unanimously and with bipartisan support in New York State. I think we can achieve that on the federal level. We just need to get there. So that's what I'm working on this year. Okay. Is, you know, searching so, for, yeah. So I don't think that there's any kind of wide opposition to it. I just feel like people are not aware of the issue. And my main job is educating people that there is this tremendous issue. I've made a video about it.
Yeah, showing, I wasn't aware. You know, I mean, I didn't know. Yeah. Like, but it's so the New York law and what you're trying to do on the national level is to make it right now is to make it cost neutral. So this passed in New York. So tell me, if somebody says, "Hey, I'm going to give my one of my kidneys to somebody else in New York," they will be what will they be reimbursed for?
So the law goes into effect April 1, 2023. And it will reimburse people for lost wages up to an annual salary of $120,000. Above that, they would get the reimbursement for the $120,000 annual salary. So if someone took 2 weeks off work, it's roughly $2,300 a week. They would get that money back from the state. This is for New Yorkers who donate to New Yorkers. Obviously, I want this to be Americans donating to Americans, though there are, you know, all kinds of things going on the international level in terms of donation that I support. I support saving lives around the globe. But for the moment, the New York law is only for New Yorkers giving to New Yorkers. The reimbursement would be for those lost wages, travel costs. Now, for me, I took the subway. I didn't really have any travel costs, but I have friends who live 3-6 hours away from the transplant center. They have to travel for their testing days. Most transplant centers I'm familiar with don't get it all done in one day, like NYU did. So they have to pay for that back and forth, the gas, the tolls, possibly hotels. When you're staying in the hospital, you may have a caregiver who brought you to the hospital who needs a hotel to stay in. And then, of course, there are the post-donation checkups. So that's, again, travel costs and possibly hotel costs, which can really add up. If someone has a child and needs childcare or is caring for an elder, those expenses are also reimbursed.
And that, I mean, that sounds great to me. That sounds like the right thing to do. I'm just listening to you talk about it. Seems like the right thing to do. Now, I was curious that this is not incentives. What you're advocating for right now is not incentives, but it's saying, and I've seen this, you know, I work in public health and there's a lot of talk about, you know, incentives for different initiatives, so to speak. And some people feel one way or some people feel the other way. And that was my question, what I meant about incentives. Like, do you think that we'll ever get there? Or is there pushback for some reason? There are people say, oh, don't go in that direction. I was curious as to if you could like maybe comment on some of those reasons, you know, what are the arguments for that? Maybe down the line, we see it happening in other countries, like you mentioned, and what are the arguments against that?
So many people say, oh, if you start if you pay people for donating their organs, then very poor people, out of a sense of desperation, are going to donate their organ in order to get a cash windfall. So I think that in a sort of an open market where you would have people setting the price for their organ and other people coming and saying they would give it for that, that could be a very toxic environment. But if the government has a set price for donating an organ, in a way, it's paying a person for their time because it is a tremendously time-consuming endeavor. They would be paid for their pain and suffering because there is pain involved in it. And so you could say, well, I'm actually just paying for the person's time and the pain they're willing to go through. Obviously, expenses would be covered. And we have a shortage. And in economics, whenever there's a shortage, you need to incentivize in order to fix the shortage. So we have a shortage of donor eggs. And so people are paid thousands of dollars for their eggs. In the same way, people could be paid for their organs. However, it's a bit different from eggs and sperm. It's more like renting someone's womb in the sense of the danger of the surgery, because the surgery can result in some really big problems, including death. And so is childbirth, right? So if someone is renting their womb out, they're opening themselves up to that kind of risk. I think people are very uncomfortable with people taking that risk and possibly doing it for financial reasons. I think there are ways around this. So for example, if you gave someone a 10-year tax credit of, let's say, $7,000 a year for 10 years, they would have to earn the money to get the money back. And it would be a very generous reimbursement, but over time, so it wouldn't be just a cash windfall. The reason I am very much in favor of this is because of the number of deaths, right? So I almost feel like it is homicide in a way for us not to take action, that we know that we could solve the kidney shortage, and yet we're not doing that. We're letting people die. I have made eye contact with some people who've not lived. I've read many stories. My son is running a service where people who desperately need kidneys will send him their biographical details. It's called Kidney Connect. And then he writes an article that hopefully will be published in their local paper to find a donor. People need more kidneys, and we are not able, through just altruistic donors, to meet that need. And I feel like a lot of people would be very willing if there was some kind of incentive, just like, you know, people show up to work. Or, you know, people even stop it at traffic lights because they're incentivized to do that. Almost everything we do is incentivized. And it's funny because the transplant surgeon is getting paid. The person who transported my organ to Georgia was paid. The entire healthcare system is paid. People are repulsed by having the supplier be paid. And I understand it. But I think that in these circumstances where you have so many deaths, we need to become educated and shift our thinking. Like I said, I do not see this happening anytime soon, but I really wish it would because, you know, people are dying. I do think reimbursements are right now a realistic initiative. I'm hopeful that New York has led the way for all 50 states to have the benefit of reimbursement. Incentivization, that's a long haul. And we definitely need leadership that cares so deeply about the gigantic number of people who are dying annually.
I think you make a lot of great points in there. And, you know, just to kind of ask people to consider the whole picture, you know, these are kind of like tough decisions, you know, dilemmas and ethical situations. It's complicated, but I hear you. I actually just watched a very disturbing documentary on organ trafficking, which I didn't even know was as rampant as it was, you know, around the world. And I just found it so disturbing, which made me think about, you know, wow, if you could empower people, you know, so they can like make a choice and make it safer and have some like regulation. I have no idea. I'm so new to this field. I'm just curious about it. If that could make a difference, you know.
I think that's where people's minds go when they hear about people getting some sort of monetary reward for donating. They think of organ trafficking. They think of people who are, you know, kidnapped and their organs taken. I don't even know if that's ever has really happened, but you know, that's where people's minds go. And also I think Hollywood and our culture makes organ donation seem like itself is, it's a very dangerous thing to do, which it is not. So I think that we have a lot of mythology going around. You know, I just watched a off-Broadway show which presented organ donation as almost like a death sentence, somebody asking you to go under the knife, and it would be such a horror, and how dare they? And it's something that keeps people up at night, you know, because they don't want to do it so badly. And I've seen it also in TV programming. There is an organization called Donate Life Hollywood that gives awards to shows that get it right. And actually, my son participated and got some sort of award as a college student for creating a video to promote donation. They understand that when people hear or see in a movie that, oh, kidney donation, it's just one of the worst and most, you know, dangerous things you can do, it's going to disincentivize thousands of people. And as a mentor, I talk to people all the time who say, isn't it dangerous? Will I ever be able to have children? Will my life be shortened? You know, and I think that that comes from the sort of myths that are spread around by our culture creators.
100%. And we tend to see the most provocative example of something and then just like run with it. But this brings me back to what was one of my favorite classes in public health was kind of like communicating through film and fiction. And because art has a way to really resonate with people in ways that, you know, just reading something or going to a website doesn't, you know, seeing that, you know, and art, it just gives you that, I don't know, there's just something special about it. So this kind of made me think of that, you know, where if you could get it right, so, you know, portray it in a way, you know, this is how it's done and people are less scared and less fearful and like, oh, okay. But, you know, the videos that we share tend to, the things we remember are like, just these, you know, really awful anecdotes, so to speak, but
Yeah. So for example, you can watch the video about organ trafficking or about people being abused.
Yeah.
But you're not going to see many videos about the number of people dying every day because of the organ shortage, right? Yeah. It's there's a reason why people become so desperate that they go abroad and try to buy kidneys from brokers who are, you know, working on in within markets that are unregulated and dangerous.
Yeah.
It's because of that desperation.
Yeah, sure.
That without a functioning kidney, you can't live another day. And so people become desperate and our system sets it up because of the organ shortage. Organ transplantation is incredibly financially great for the taxpayer too. It saves tremendous amounts of money. The most recent article I read by Frank McCormick and Philip Held is that $416,000 are saved every time someone is transplanted. So if we reimburse somebody, I think it's on average about $8,000 for their costs. The taxpayer, it's still a huge win. And so I think it's important for us to understand that it is not dangerous. It is very life-giving and it's amazingly cost-saving. Right now, 1% of the federal budget, that's one out of every $100 is spent on kidney disease. It is so expensive. It's more expensive than NASA or the State Department or foreign aid. It's incredibly expensive. And so, and it's really sad because diabetes is the number one reason for kidneys to fail. 40% of Americans are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. That's why I do work so hard with having people eat healthier in order to avoid or reverse type 2 diabetes. But I've talked to people who have taken a diet pill that caused their kidneys to fail, you know, because we have an unregulated supplement and diet pill market. I've talked to people who were on certain kinds of antipsychotics or antidepressants that ruined their kidneys. So it's not only because of people's diets, but, you know, genetic diseases. I know a lot of people who are very young and very sick because of genetic diseases. There are a lot of reasons why the kidneys fail. And we just really need to be more willing to help the people who are facing death as a result of their kidney failure. Really breaks my heart.
I wanted to ask you about the donation, the types, the paired exchange, and then the donor chain. I'm not sure. I mean, I really wasn't familiar with those until I read the stuff on your website. So can you tell us what those are, what the differences are there?
Sure. There's a man named Alvin Roth. He is a professor and he won the Nobel Prize for coming up with the idea of kidney chains. And the idea is that you can, as in my case, you can get your bang for the buck, right? You have one person who's willing to give to a stranger, and then you line up people. And sometimes these kidney chains are, you know, just two people. And sometimes I think they can go as long as 100 people, though these days they do shorter chains because they're less likely to break down. You can imagine the complexity. So what they do is they just make sure they have all 50 states and they have the information on the computer to make the matches. The National Kidney Registry is the one who organizes these matches and paired exchanges. They have all the data and they make that happen, as I described earlier. For a paired exchange, let's imagine that I wanted to give to my husband and there was another pair out there. I was a good, as a donor, a good match for the recipient, and my husband would be a good match for their donor. And then it's like, you know, swapping. So it turns out that it's faster, as I said earlier, to participate in giving to a stranger and getting a voucher from the National Kidney Registry that you can give to a loved one, rather than a paired exchange. You're more likely to get a better match and you're more likely to have it happen faster, which makes a lot of sense, right? That sort of perfect match of the two couples is a little hard to swing. But it's a really great opportunity to save more than just one life. My son really wanted to do launch a chain. And when he went to the hospital, they were not yet a member of National Kidney Registry. And they also had a patient down the hall who wouldn't live much longer, who was only 2 years older than my son. And my son said, absolutely, let's make it happen. And I said, I'll be the chain. You can count me as your chain. And so in total, we've helped 5 people get life-saving kidneys, which is just the most rewarding feeling of any decision I've made.
I have, so is there anything, so the donors who give their kidneys, and this is all documented, say, you know, something happens to the kidney that they have down the line, is there anything in place for that? I was just curious about that.
Yes, absolutely. So there are two kinds of direct donors. There's the direct donor who knows the recipient, and then there's the non-directed donor, also called altruistic donor, Good Samaritan donor, who gives to a stranger. For a person who gives to a stranger through the National Kidney Registry, in my case, I have a voucher that if I ever need a kidney for any reason, though it's very unlikely I will need one, I can go to the top of the living donor wait list and get a living kidney. Why would I want a living kidney? They tend to last twice as long as a deceased donor kidney. So they may last 15 to 20 years and a deceased donor kidney 10 to 15 years. Though I was so excited to read an article recently of a man who has a 56-year-old kidney and it's still going. So if you take good care of it and you have good fortune, it could last much longer than what I just stated. In the case of, you know, people would say to me, hey, you're giving your kidney to a stranger. What if someone in your family needs it? So the National Kidney Registry has a family voucher program. You can list up to 5 people, family and friends, who if one of them needs a kidney, they would also go to the top of the wait list. And so, wow. You know, my son, my husband, and some other people are on that. And that gives me peace of mind that my kidney, first of all, would I be a good match? That's a question. They'll get a great match. Not the likelihood they'll ever need it is very low. If I was a direct donor, so I'm giving to someone I already knew, not through the National Kidney Registry, not through the voucher program, I would, if I ever needed a kidney, I would go to the top of the list, top of the wait list. Now that would be for a deceased or a living kidney. It is very possible to live a long, full life with a deceased donor kidney. And so at the top of that list, that person would go if they ever needed one. So we're protected. All donors are protected in that way. And that really gives us peace of mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what is the biggest, you had on your website, I watched the video where some of the donors who donated to strangers talk about their experience. And to me, I was like, wow. So I was curious, what is the biggest reason you hear why people would donate a kidney to a stranger? To some people, it might seem like such a foreign concept, like no way, like I'm keeping my kidneys like just for a rainy day. But yeah, what is the greatest motivation there?
I've met about 50 people who've given our kidneys to strangers. And I would just say the number one reason is because we can. We found out that we could and we can. And so, you know, people compare it to, you know, if you have a life jacket and you have 2 life jackets, someone's drowning, you throw them the life jacket, or you're starving, and you've got 2 loaves of bread, you hand that person a loaf of bread. For most of us, it's just that we can. And for most of us, it was a quick decision once we were educated. And that's one of the reasons why I would really love for us to do a gigantic educational campaign to just share that we can, because I feel like there are thousands of people who aren't aware of it. I talk to them every day, who would just step forward and say, let me do this thing. I know most people don't feel that way, but there is this tribe of people. I can't really describe them, except they're very fun to hang out with, who are game to do this thing. And so that's the biggest motivation, is just this understanding my life won't change a drop, but I can actually understand that my body was used to save a life and I didn't need to wait until I died to do this. I can still be alive and feel the pleasure of that gift. And I cannot come up with really good words to describe how I have this sort of waterfall of joy every time I think about what I've done. It just sets me into like a magic carpet ride of happiness. So I feel like a lot of us are on the happier side. We are people who are action oriented and very generous. So that would describe us. Everyone I've met who's done this thing, as I said, there are many who wouldn't, but I feel like there's an untapped pool of people who really would if they knew about it.
I mean, and there's certainly lots of studies. When you mentioned the magic carpet ride of joy, which is a great picture, by the way, I love that. but that there's altruism has been linked to that, you know, just doing something like this. And I can imagine, like, you save somebody's life and just knowing that every day, you don't have to know who they are. Yeah, it must be an amazing feeling.
Amazing. Yeah. And I highly recommend it for anyone who's game. And I would also be happy to talk to anyone and share my experience and answer their questions.
Yeah.
My email is elaine@weightlesszero.org. You know, please be in touch with me. I love sharing my experience. I love answering questions and holding people's hands through the process.
And so you just mentioned your email. And so weightlesszero.com, is that?
.org.
.org, sorry.
Yeah,
.org.
Yeah. It's okay.
I'm still in the .com phase.
It's okay.
So that's where people can go if they want to check that out. And your advocacy work in order to get a law like this passed nationwide, still go to Weightless Zero or email you.
Emailing me is the best bet. Our website is being refreshed. So I advocated all of last year and joked around with myself that I persuaded seventh graders to write essays so I can persuade anyone to do anything at this point. I think being a teacher is very helpful in the sense that as teachers, we just keep it moving and we keep going in a positive direction, no matter the circumstances. So I have found that my skills transfer well to this persuasion campaign. I'm now looking for a sponsor in both the House and Senate. I have made a lot of connections, and that's my main job now, is getting a sponsor, then co-sponsors, then pushing people to bring it to the floor, bring it to a vote, and obviously for the president to sign it. I was speaking with an advocate not long ago who I said something about me being a newcomer. This was last year with my work in Albany in New York. And he said, listen, you keep referring to yourself as a beginner, but you are committed. He said, now this is not a vegan thing to say, but he said, on the breakfast plate, you've got the eggs and the bacon, the chicken contributed, but the pig was committed. So, you know, from the time I got it from the operating table, I was fully committed to this effort. And I feel like this is a great opportunity to just bring in common sense legislation so we can at least move forward in the sense that no one's going to spend any money to donate. And from there, I hope to become more expansive. Another thing that I'm doing is I'm beginning to do education. So I walk around New York with a sandwich board sign that says, gifted my kidney to a stranger, ask me anything. And it's just a way to share with people that we can gift our kidneys to strangers. And I have really interesting conversations, as you can imagine, about it. It's something that's widely noticed, which is great. So it's my personal education campaign. I'm also going to start going to different festivals with my friend Patty Graham, another mentor, and we hope to just educate people that this is something that is really, really valuable.
I love that. I mean, that sign will get people to stop. I'm in New York too. So
oh, great.
If I see you, I'll say hello if I'm out with my dog.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you live?
Near like Gramercy, the Gramercy area.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, I live near Columbia, so
oh, nice,
not too far away.
Okay,
but diagonal.
Yeah, you're like close to the park. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, that's,
yeah.
I run up in Central Park all the time.
I love Central Park.
Me too. Me too. I try to like. I go there, I run up there with my headphones on. And then when I get there, I go into the Ramble, turn the music off. And I'm just like, oh, you can listen to birds and the little, you know, streams. So,
oh, I'm happy for you. That's beautiful. Yeah.
Kind of like my nature therapy in the city, as close as I
it's
can
great. Listen, I have more contact with nature here than I did growing up in a small town. Cause we had a park, but it had creeps in it, you know? So like you wouldn't go to the park.
Yeah. That's the same exact thing. I grew up in a small town. It was like, be careful at the park. There's So, central and you know, around springtime, it's just great. And like, we're really lucky to have it. Yeah.
So lucky.
Yeah. But this is great. Elaine, thank you so much for your time. I learned a lot from this. This was a topic I was completely ignorant on. So I appreciate the education. And then I look forward to getting it out there. And I'm sure some of my listeners, they might write you. Who knows? But this was really good. And best of luck with the legislation and all of that. I think it's...
Thank you. I'll keep you posted on the progress of the legislation.
Yes.
And... it is, yeah, I'm very happy for people to get in touch with me. I know that it is something, 95% of people who donate would do it again in surveys. So it's something that is really felt as something
that's
worthwhile
telling.
Doing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just have enjoyed speaking with you and sharing what I know, and I'm still learning, but I feel like, we have something that's so life-giving, and I feel like a lot more people, if they knew about it, would be willing to, you know, have a little bit of pain and discomfort, a little bit of time consumed, but knowing that they've saved a life. What could be better than that?
Yeah, I think demystifying it for people, you know, and kind of replacing the fear and anxiety with knowledge and education is really, really helpful, you know.
100%.
100%. Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Elaine. And Ollie, we'll keep in touch. I'll follow up via email.
Excellent. Thanks for your time and thanks for inviting me. I'm
sure
really
thing.
Honored.
Absolutely. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for joining into the podcast. I hope you stick around, subscribe, tell a friend if you can, tell an enemy. I don't care. A subscriber is a subscriber. Everybody's welcome. So after listening to the podcast, I'll go back to the question I asked all of you at the beginning. Would you ever consider donating one of your kidneys to a perfect stranger? Have your views changed at all? Man, it's too bad I can't build in like a survey or something to see the results. Well, I mean, okay, you could write me on Facebook, Instagram, or through my website, bloomingwellness.com or erin@bloomingwellness.com, and let me know. Tell me if you want to. There's no mandates here. And now time for the closing quote, so everyone can get on with their day. This quote is from a very serious show, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. At least I think it is. It's hard to know, like, you know, if the quote is from where everybody says it's from online, but I guess it is. And everybody has all these thoughts about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. You know, all I can say, good for her. Good for Snow White. All right, here we go. Ready? Here's the quote. Remember, you're the one who can fill the world with sunshine. I like that. All right, so go out there and spread some sunshine, or if you have to, give someone a sunshine pump who needs it. You all know what I mean. Yep, the sunshine pump. All right, have a great rest of your day, and hopefully see you here next time. Bye for now.